I'm Amber French, the editor of The Source, which, as you know, is the Migration Policy Institute's online journal. This Q&A is intended to delve into the extremely important and timely topic of the Syrian conflict, focusing on issues relating to medical emergency and health of the hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees and displaced population from the Syrian conflict. So I am here with Dr. Fadi Al-Kankan, a pulmonologist originally from the city of Homs, Syria. Dr. Kankan is the chairman of the Humanitarian Committee and a member of the Medical Committee of the Syrian Expatriates Organization. He has been an assistant professor and faculty senator at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia, since 2003. He specializes in pulmonary and sleep medicine and is a graduate of Aleppo University. Dr. Al-Kankan is also actively involved in a number of organizations, including the American College of Chest Physicians, the Syrian American Council, and the Syrian American Medical Society. To my left is Kathleen Newland, MPI co-founder and director of the Migrants, Migration, and Development and Refugee Policy Programs, as well as International Rescue Committee overseer. So she has visited Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and Iraq in late November with members of the IRC delegation. Is that correct?
Actually, I only went to Jordan and Turkey.
So or Jordan
other
and
members
Turkey.
Of the delegation went to Iraq and Lebanon.
Okay. So I would like to proceed with roughly 7 or 8 questions, and many of them are directed to you and your experience on the ground in Syria and also with your activities with SEO. And then there are a few that are directed to Kathleen to have her views when she was traveling in the region and also the work of IRC. So I'll begin with Dr. Al-Kankan. When and how did the Syrian Expatriates Organization first become involved in the Syrian conflict on the ground? How has SEO's involvement evolved? And is this different from what the organization was expecting at the onset?
At the SEO, we started from the beginning of revolution. Initially, it was a Facebook movement, the same as the Syrian revolution or Egypt, in Egypt or in Yemen. It was a Facebook movement, and that make us to really organize ourselves and to establish that organization to help to make democracy Syria. Over the last 2 years, we have been working from day number one. We had applied for non-profit organization and we got approved. We roughly more than 200 professionals in the United States and Canada organized ourselves. Most of us is first generation here. So we know the Syrian people language, we know the culture, we know what they need. Our group that organized and covered most of the areas in South Syria from north to south. Most of us has been activists in multiple ways, and also we are most of us as members of other organizations. Initially we started as a movement on the Facebook. Then we started mainly in revolutionary support. And then we moved forward to, as the need of the revolution has changed from the beginning when it was a revolution of freedom to now a revolution of medical and the humanitarian aids besides freedom. So we have moved forward and became more organized, made up multiple committees, each committee specialized in a way of supporting the Syrian people.
Excellent. So there was this recent report, the International Rescue Committee's report on Syria, a regional crisis. And as I was going through the report, I noticed that there was a statement. Doctors described to the IRC a systematic campaign to restrict access to life-saving healthcare through the strategic bombing and forced closure of hospitals and healthcare facilities. So had anyone anticipated the attacks targeting hospitals? And could you speak a little more to the ways in which doctors and other staff have responded?
The regime has been targeting the key points in each city. As we said, we divide the areas inside Syria to two zones, zone under the authority of the regime and the other is freed. In those zones, the regime has been trying to target the key points, the infrastructure of each cities. We went through whole cities that targeting gas stations, bakeries, and hospitals. They left nothing. So the infrastructure of the cities has been destroyed. Hospital, for example, that what we heard recently, what they send the gas to one of the gas stations. So people rush to get some diesel for heating, and then they pumped it to have the most casualties. So hospitals are really targeted largely. Mm-hmm. And that moved us from using the public hospitals, like in Homs, the National Hospital of Homs has been bombed and it's exerted now, to make up a secret field hospitals. Hospitals inside has been now like what I want to imagine just because of the need that has moved to more organized to three classes of hospital. Field hospital at the field, on the front line, to a little bit larger hospital to perform a little bit more operation, to a larger hospital that's on the borders to perform more sophisticated surgeries.
Okay, great. So, Kathleen, is this typical of other crises? Have we heard in other recent violent conflicts targeted attacks on hospitals and on other important centers for living?
I think the Syrian crisis is unusual in the extent of the targeting of medical facilities and medical personnel also. I mean, we were told by some of your colleagues we talked to in Jordan that a colleague had recently been stopped as he was crossing the border back into Syria and was found to have medical equipment in his car. And the Syrian authorities treated him exactly the same as if he had been importing weapons. And they said if you're found with blood bags or, you know, things that are clearly palliative care, that it's just the same as if you had weapons in the eyes of the Syrian authorities. And I think that is unusual in the extremes to which the regime is going to undermine the support systems of the civilian population. And as Dr. Al-Khankan has said, it's not just the hospitals, but obviously in a time of war, hospitals and medical personnel are extremely critical to literally to the survival of people. And also psychologically, I think that I also have, and Dr. Al-Khankan can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've also heard that particularly in Syria that the medical profession had a special status, and that maybe it's because the dictator is himself a doctor, I don't know, but medicine is a very prestigious field, that the regime had invested in medical schools and so on, and perhaps thinking that the medical profession is sort of apolitical, and that it's something, an area that was sort of safe to be developed within Syria because no, you know, NGOs or civil society was deliberately really kept down. Well, that was obviously a miscalculation on the part of the regime because Syrian doctors have been among the most sort of activist and strongest supporters of the revolution. But
mm-hmm. Yes.
It's in Syria, being a doctor was really implanted by families. Look how many Syrian doctors here in the United States. I mean, it's compared to other immigrants from other countries. Even Syria is much, much smaller than India or Pakistan or China, and you see a lot of doctors here. What's going on in Syria, the doctor personnel are facing a huge burden. Even with the healthcare professionals who's working for the regime, For example, they had to execute the wounded. They should not be able to help the wounded people, even civilians from the fighters, from the other riotous fighters. So, and it's unfortunate to look at Syria now, and you see a lot of shortage in doctors, and all those doctors outside Syria.
Like you mentioned during the event earlier today, I was surprised to hear about the audience member who mentioned some of the medical students having their certificates pulled. And have you encountered this in your work?
Yes, there has been a lot of medical students. They pulled their certificates. Unfortunately, even the medical students who flee because they are wanted, because they protest against the regime, they can't get their certificates out. They cannot get what proof they have been students there.
Mm-hmm.
They have been targeted by the secret services. So it's very hard, and most of them is just working in field hospitals trying to help other people.
Okay. So Kathleen did mention this a bit, but I did want to also have your point of view, Dr. Okankan, on the kind of the uniqueness of the Syrian conflict from a medical emergency perspective. And so Kathleen mentioned especially just the extent to which the Syrian regime had targeted hospitals. And so are there any other thoughts that you have on the uniqueness of this conflict from a medical emergency perspective? For example, the health of refugees, not only in camps but also in urban settings. Are there any particular challenges that you face in addressing, or that not necessarily SCO, but that the international community should be aware of in addressing health issues for refugees in both settings?
The problem is there is really, if you look at health is not a medicine, you prescribe a prescription or medical supply. Health is a whole socio-economical status, shelters to sleep in, a hot water to take a bath, a clean food to eat, clean clothes, washing, electricity, gas, heat. So it's a big dilemma. Most of the work has been going on in field hospital, taking care of the wounded. Not enough work has been done to help the chronic disease, hypertension, diabetes, those sick people who has been really sick. They need medicine, or there is no also preventive medicine. I mean, we met a people like who has not taken a bath for 6 to 8 months. There is no hot water. They live in a tent, and they eat. They have with a small fire around. I mean, I look at the, for example, Atma camp. You see people living in tents in that cold weather between the olive trees. We saw children has no milk to drink. Women has not able to breastfeed their children because they are not eating healthy food. So the disaster is not only medical. I mean, by just trying to provide medical aid is not enough. You need a huge resource for humanitarian to help the socio-economic status of those people.
Okay, I understand. Indeed, the report, the IRC report, had stated that while camps sheltering Syrian refugees capture most of the media attention and international funding, they do not attract the majority of Syrian refugees, and many more currently reside in urban and rural areas, not in camps. And in some of these, as you addressed, challenges to the health of refugees really comes from this idea that health is not just a medicine, but an entire cohesive package of especially very specific health needs for children and for women. So it was nice that you had spoken to this question. And so, but on a more positive note, have medical emergencies arising from the Syrian conflict given way to or indicated the need for any particular innovations or inventions in the medical or medical emergency industry?
We have worked very well in making a lot of field hospitals inside Syria. There has been a lot of volunteers. They went inside Syria, organized. We have been working for with a lot of programs like physician sponsoring program, where we match each doctor who's working in Canada or America, match and try to help a doctor inside Syria. So we had a lot of physicians working in South Syria, and we have a matching between physicians outside and inside. We helped, and we are working now on telemedicine. We're trying to open through the internet, making conferences between a doctor outside who's very well specialized here to another doctor inside for consultations, and making call schedule and making people to cover all the basic needs for the people inside. We have been trying to collect a lot of supplies, medical supplies, carry on. We are very organized in sending people for visiting inside Syria. And we are we have a call, we know where to send the doctor. Even sometimes we collect cases, for example, for neurology. So one of the neurologists will go there and see his own patients. Containers full of medical supplies we have been trying to send there. We sent one before, and we are trying to send another one. But the need is so huge that not a single organization or one country can carry on. We need the whole world to stand up for Syrian people, to help in all way aspect of this crisis.
Okay. Can I add something to that? One thing that I observed in Jordan also was a great deal of sophistication in the supply chains for medical supplies and equipment. And it was really impressive to see that as part of this communications revolution, Dr. Al-Khankan mentioned, you know, that he was Skyping with a fellow doctor inside Syria and this kind of thing. They are also, doctors are able to, if they're able to connect with an organization that has supplies to send, to tell them exactly what they need. You know, we need so many antibiotics, we need blood bags, we need forceps, you know, whatever it is that is needed. And those packages can be assembled, electronically tagged, sent into Syria where they are. The electronic tag is snapped with a smartphone, and with the geolocation devices then sent to a drop box so the donors can be sure that the exact supplies they sent arrived at the exact place they were intended to arrive. And, you know, this may seem trivial in a war situation, but it's very important to donors to know that their supplies are not being diverted to the Syrian army, or they are getting across the border, they're not going into the black market. So the uses of communications technology have really, and by a population both in Syria and among Syrian expatriates, it's very sophisticated in the use of Facebook and Skype and all the tools, you know, the Dropbox that makes it possible to leave a message or to track supplies in a completely anonymous way, so that, you know, if somebody accesses the Dropbox, they can't tell who the messages come from or where it's going. It just exists in cyberspace, so it's much safer. And it's very reassuring to donors, and we certainly hope that it will encourage them to give more.
Yeah. Would you have any statements?
The most of the doctors there, I know the work is not enough. We have a lot of things to do, a lot of work to do. But people inside, the doctors especially, they are working voluntarily. So imagine of a doctor who left his family, left his children, and went inside living in one of the field hospitals. So you see their work. It's really a lot of it. You feel like they are doing it tremendous, way beyond a human being can do or other doctors. I was amazed by how much innovations they have been doing, how many surgeries what they are using. Like I saw a doctor who has a flashlight, and he imagined I opened the abdomen with this flashlight in my hand with a battery because there is no electricity. I saw a lot of non-medical personnel. For example, when one of the field hospital I was visiting there, I can't say the name where it is, North Syria. One of the field hospitals, we saw the ICU run by a two-year college student who just finished an institute of 2 years, and he ran it very well. He ran it really very well as a good physician who has been trained in internal medicine and then a critical care medicine for a total of 5 years after medical school training. Mm-hmm. So I saw a lot of personnel who's very well acceptably trained because of the need. People has to come out and do whatever they have to do.
Indeed. Kathleen, when you were visiting, I understand it was early November, and so at this time of the year, the area is beginning to prepare for the winter, and I understand that winterization is a major concern. And this is entirely relevant to health because, as we have been discussing earlier today, just the impact of winter on the refugees. So, would you mind saying a few words about the risk, perhaps of epidemics or related to the coming winter, and also with most of the displaced people not equipped to withstand cold winter? What are the health considerations of winter?
Well, Dr. Al-Kantan would be able to speak much more technically than I about the kind of medical problems you see, but I think, you know, just on an intuitive level, we can all understand that living in a tent in the midst of winter, and it is a particularly hard and wet winter that they're having in and around Syria this year. So last week, the main refugee camp in the north of Jordan was flooded. The tents were blown down. People's clothes and blankets got soaked. And those are the ones who were in an internationally run and supervised camp. The people who run camps, both in Turkey and in Jordan, are trying to move more to trailers than tents, to sort of small containers, which are more weatherproof but still very cold. And a lot of the people who fled from Syria thought this would be over in a few months. And so they came out in the summer. They didn't bring warm clothes. They didn't have, you know, their basic supplies to withstand the cold. So, you know, the winterization programs and the Syrian Expatriate Organization is involved with winterization as well. Are sending in, you know, just very basic things like rubber boots, because so many of these settlements, you know, it's wet, you know, it's muddy. People are, you know, it's really easy to get sick when you're just cold and wet. Mm-hmm. People don't, you know, in the cities, particularly big cities where there's been so much destruction of the infrastructure, like Aleppo. People don't have firewood, they don't have diesel or kerosene to keep themselves warm. So just getting warm clothes, blankets, waterproof footwear. I mean, the winterization kits that I've seen in are, you know, mattresses to keep people off the cold ground, tarps to keep the rain off, you know, rubber boots, blankets, you know, the most basic kind of supplies, just to keep people going through this awful winter.
What is the winter period in Syria typically? How long does it run? When does it start? When does it end?
Usually it's 3.5 months, start by November and end up by the end of February.
Okay.
In the winter, we are facing a huge need in Syria because Syria is a cold country. And it has been snowing now in many cities in Syria. So what we are facing a long-term effect on the Syrian people this month. People need is so bad that they need everything. People living in a tent. People have been using trees, olive trees, for heating. Look how many tents, a fire just killed 7 people in Atma camp in North Syria. If you look at the people is inside, a lot of disease from lack of bathing and water, from scabies to chronic diarrhea, skin lesions, it has been reported. People lack of medicine, there is no maintenance medicine, no prophylactic medicines, no chronic no money to bring medicine, pills, chronic pills, insulin. These need, for example, a lot of medicine need to be refrigerated. There is no electricity. So we're looking at a huge disaster that can affect even the environment by cutting all these trees and use them. It's going to have a long-term effect in lack of medical professional, medical supplies, hospitals, infrastructure that's destroyed. It's not going to end in a year or two. It's going to take a long time.
Okay. And are there any risks of epidemics at this point?
The risk is there. What I'm afraid of that it may have started, but there is no way of really that much organized way of discovering it early. The risk is really huge. This will start, and this makes sense. If you look at so much people sitting in a small a big prison, like especially in the areas where the controlled by the regime, and you can see these people is gonna have a disease that's gonna be epidemic between them.
What types of diseases are you
respiratory flu?
From respiratory flu, TB a lot. Even it's endemic in Syria, but also. What make things, first of all, it's very hard to discover, but also there has been no gathering of people inside one place because of the regime has been pumping, so people trying to spread away, and that may also make it very hard to see in a big scale, but it may start in a camp around the cities or where people is really fleeing the shelling.
We hear about continuing attacks on the civilian population and medical facilities and personnel in particular. What are the obstacles to your work, whether related to resources, administration, violence, or other? How difficult is it to get medical supplies to where they are needed?
There has been a lot of obstacles, starting by the very limited resources we have, money-wise, medical supplies, starting by the safety of the medical personnel and how to bring things inside. The problem is there is no a non-government organization ever has been able to work inside Syria freely without their personnel being tortured and targeted by the regime. And most of the old non-government organizations in Syria, they are 100%, we know that, is pro-regime, like Syrian Red Cross, Red Crescent. They are pro-regime, and if you work with them, it's very hard to guarantee the reach of the humanitarian aids and medical aids to the right people. So the main obstacle that people working inside Syria is undercover. They are well organized, but they are using cover to work. So it's very hard to deliver a large scale humanitarian or medical aid to one place without smuggling them in a way difficult roads to get them in. And the Syria also can be divided into zones. Each one is unique by their need. For example, in northern Syria, there is a way of getting in from Turkey. They just need the help. In southern Syria, there is few ways you can come in from Jordan. But in the middle also, there is a lot of whole villages like Al-Hula. Al-Hula in beside Homs. it's very well surrounded by pro-regime cities, so it's very hard to get anything in or out. So it's the work is devastated, and that's why we started to have one of our member that specialized in one area and see what's the need in each one by one, either medical or humanitarian, and try to provide that need for each area different than the other.
Okay. Do you have any additional thoughts to share on the obstacles?
I was wondering, has the regime tried to block your communications, cell phones, Skype, Facebook? Has there been any sort of cyber attack on the work you're doing?
Yes. We are using mainly satellite internet. Syria, because Syria is close to Europe, so the satellite internet has been really successful way of communicating inside Syria. It's very hard, a lot of ways for the regime to be able to track these. Especially Skype is very well encrypted, or VPN we're using, and the satellite internet is by using European satellites. So it's very hard for the regime to be able to track them. There has been a lot of people, activists inside, lost their Facebook accounts. People has been their friends being targeted there inside Syria. Their families has been suffering because of that and targeted. But really, because of need, made people really move to what to do. Innovations. They were able to find out a way of communicating outside. And basically now I freely talk to a lot of activists inside Syria over Skype, and they are using a satellite internet that cannot be traced. So we were able to do that.
That's really made a huge difference, I think.
I found a lot of hospitals, especially in northern Syria, they are using diesel-based electricity generators. So there's no electricity there, but they have it in each hospital, each house where the satellite there, over a Wi-Fi covering that hospital, and we are freely able to talk over Skype to people here and tell them what we saw there, for example.
That's amazing.
That is. I have one last question, and then can wrap up. But you mentioned during the event this morning that many wounded Syrians were being treated free of charge in Turkish hospitals. Have you heard of, and also Kathleen, if you have heard of any such incidents in other neighboring countries? What is known about the state of healthcare systems in Syria's neighboring countries since the beginning of the refugee crisis?
Well, the surrounding countries, and particularly Jordan and Turkey, where I have seen it more, but I think also under the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq, and to some extent in Lebanon, although I think it's less organized in Lebanon. But Lebanon and Syria have such close interactions that a lot of people have gone to Lebanon. And the authorities in those countries have opened their healthcare systems, opened their schools to Syrian refugees. Now, Dr. Al-Khankan mentioned in his presentation this morning that, you know, it's difficult in Turkey because the language is, you know, the schools are taught in Arabic and, you know, in Turkish, and Syrian students are taught in Arabic, so it's more difficult. But in Jordan, a lot of the U.S. assistance that has gone to Jordan, both during the Iraqi refugee crisis and now, has been to support their school system so that they can put on double shifts, so that they can hire additional teachers, so that they can take Syrian refugee children into the Jordanian schools. It's a tremendous lift. I mean, there are a lot of kids a lot of the schools just aren't able to absorb more children. So, you know, it's, in theory, it's a good system, but in practice, it's under tremendous strain. And the same is true of the medical care, the clinics, these two small towns in northern Jordan that we went to, Mafraq and I'm not remembering the name of the second one, but the International Rescue Committee has set up clinics which are open to local residents but are specifically set up to treat Syrian refugees, to relieve some of the burden on the local hospitals and clinics, because they are just overwhelmed. And they're also working very closely with the local hospitals, pharmacies, and clinics, so that if they give a prescription to a refugee, he or she can take that script to a local pharmacy and try to find one that has the medicine in stock. But I think the neighboring countries are really trying to be helpful, but it is increasingly difficult for them, and I think especially Jordan and Lebanon, because the systems are not as highly developed as they are in Turkey. They're much poorer countries. Well, things are pretty chaotic in Lebanon, especially along the border, I guess. So it's really very difficult. There haven't been so many refugees, but growing numbers are going to the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. And it's remote. The situation is pretty difficult there, too. Two of our delegation went to northern Iraq, and about half the people are in camps. But it's not easy anywhere. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found really very frustrating to hear is that the international community initially held back on giving financial assistance to Turkey for the refugee operations because the Turks were adhering to too high a standard. They were putting people in containers rather than in tents. They were providing levels of services that are above the minimum of what's considered to be acceptable to the international community, and I thought that's just insane. That's really, we start punishing countries for being treating refugees too well. It's really pathetic. But I think I think there's been some resolution of that. But I think Jordan, Lebanon, and to some extent northern Iraq are nowhere near the international standards for the basic kind of care and services that people should have access to.
Do you have any additional thoughts?
What I want to say is usually medical supplies are based on the population needs. For example, In a small city here in Virginia, you are not going to open a big hospital in the middle of nowhere for a population of 1,000, 2,000 people. And that's what's going on in those surrounding countries, where we're not prepared for this huge number, sudden increase in their populations. So they have a limited supplies, or it was way beyond what everybody expected nationwide. So no such a country by itself can bear or help this huge number of people in need, either humanitarian or medicals. There is not that much big hospitals, and even the areas surrounding Syria are not huge cities with big hospitals. So nobody can bear, and nobody can do really take this big burden. No countries can do that on their own. The more has been successful is Turkey, more than other countries, as Kathleen said, because Turkey is a big country. I mean, the population of Istanbul much way than all the Syrians on the world, just Istanbul city. Right. So they have been able to because it's a much bigger country, and they have the willingness, the intention, and the capability of working, and they have been doing a tremendous job. Still not enough. There is still a lot of lack of hospitals, ICUs, and the ICUs in the all surrounding hospital has been really full with wounded Syrians. Other countries not will be able to, like Jordan and Lebanon and the Turkish side of Iraq, because they are small countries and they cannot really take all these refugees, and they have a comparable number of refugees as Turkey has. So we're looking at the whole international committees to intervene, to help, to to really make a coalition, use the Syrian coalition to help to organize. There is no such one organization is really working with other organizations to help. We need all the organizations to really interfere mm-hmm. and help and organize what should be done for the Syrian people. The same as what happened in Libya, and that will be really helpful down the road.
Well, do you have any additional comments or things to mention? So, great. I would like to thank you, Dr. Al-Kankan and Kathleen Newland, for participating in this Q&A, and I would like to invite the audience to visit the Source website for further information at www.migrationinformation.org.